In the center of it stood a wide metal box covered with bright white panels that reminded Lazarin of the same technology as the columns they had seen in the upper chambers. Behind it, extending up from the base, was a series of mechanical arms. They were dozens of meters long, and each was articulated with at least two joints. At the end of each was a three-pronged extension, two that looked like pincers, and the third that was a simple tube. At rest, the contraption looked like a gigantic spider resting on its back, with its legs in the air. Crisscrossing the vast open interior of the cavern were thick ropes of silver and black metal, as if the stone surrounding similar veins running through the walls had been chipped away, leaving only the ore. The twisted deposits were similar to the constructs found on the surface, with two notable exceptions. First, all of the long, dense veins were illuminated from within, a bright white light source dazzling the silver and only slightly muted by the interwoven blackness of the metal. The light burned from the center and played in dazzling patterns all over the cavern walls. Second, the veins were in constant motion, gyrating and undulating like massive living snakes. Finally, Lazarin thought to remove his tricorder and begin to scan. The first thing he noted was the presence of vast quantities of the Seven of Nanonium.
"Well, that's one mystery solved," he said softly.
Vincent and Japel had also conquered their awe and were moving around the center platform taking their own readings.
Guys,
Vincent said. Lazarin turned toward Vincent and saw several meters beyond him a gigantic waterfall of sorts. Flowing over a tall, smooth stone was a viscous black liquid. Several thin cords hung above it, each one extending from one of the moving veins above. Every so often, a single drop of the black liquid fell from above and was added to the fall. It was impossible to see how far down the fall extended. Past a few hundred meters, even the light from the undulating metal did not illuminate the bottom of the cavern.
"Any idea what that is?"
Lazarin asked.
"Nope. The tricorder can't even figure out its molecular structure,"
Vincent replied.
"Should I try to take a sample?"
"Let's not touch anything just yet," Lazarin suggested.
"Why don't we head back? It's going to take more people than us to unravel all of this. We should signal for one of the engineering teams to join us as soon as possible."
"Do you think Devi will agree to that?"
Japel asked. Lazarin shrugged.
"Our rotation is only 5 days. We could spend 10 times that down here and not make a dent. I think we can convince her to share."
"One second," Japel said.
"What is that?" he asked, pointing to another circular platform high overhead and a good half a kilometer in the distance. Its construction was similar to the platform on which they stood, but without the giant spider. Instead, a single large white sphere rested in its center, with dozens of white pipes extending from its center and terminating all throughout the cavern at different points. There were also a dozen or so pipes of dull gray, perhaps no longer functioning.
"I have no idea,"
Lazarin said,
"but there's plenty of time to figure it out. Let's get back to Devi before she starts to worry."
Nods from Japel and Vincent settled the matter. Together, they retreated to the doorway and began their ascent. Voyager. Icheb didn't even remember how he had bid farewell for the evening to Finn. Something about an early start in the morning. It had been lame and awkward. Finn's face, even in the dimness, had betrayed his confusion. But Icheb couldn't think about that right now. He had a bigger problem. As soon as he'd returned to the ship, he'd tried to contact the doctor and been told he was tending to a patient aboard Voyager. Icheb had considered waiting until morning, but with the doctor so near, his anxiety got the better of him. When he entered sick bay, the lights were low. At the far end of the bay, he saw a patient resting on a biobed behind a force field. Curious, he stepped closer and recognized Ensign Gwyn.
"May I help you, Ensign Icheb?"
the warm, melodious voice of Dr. Sherrick asked. Icheb turned.
"I was looking for the doctor, the EMH. I was told he was here."
"Of course,"
Sherrick said, gesturing toward his office. Inside, the doctor sat at Sherrick's desk, studying the screen before him intently.
"Excuse me, doctor,"
The doctor looked up. Icheb, are you okay?
I am, Icheb said. I have a personal matter I need to discuss with you.
Oh, the doctor said, glancing toward Sherrick, who hovered just behind Icheb. Icheb turned to see Sherrick nod sagely before returning to his duties in the main bay.
I did not mean to insult Dr. Sherrick,
Icheb said, as soon as he and the doctor were alone.
I don't think you did. Have you come to me with a medical question?
The doctor asked kindly.
I don't know, Icheb replied honestly. Would you prefer I discuss this with Dr. Sherrick?
Sherrick is an excellent physician, and as a member of Voyager's crew, your health needs fall within his purview. But I am your friend, and I will be happy to address any concerns you might have in that capacity.
Icheb nodded.
Thank you.
The doctor perched himself on the front of Sherrick's desk and said, Take a seat. Icheb felt his face growing warm. He looked at the empty chairs situated before the desk and shook his head. The doctor leaned forward, his concern obvious.
What's wrong, Icheb?
I experienced something I do not understand tonight. I'm afraid it might be evidence of a problem.
That sounds serious, the doctor said.
I have never...
Icheb began.
I mean, there have been very few times in my life when I have interacted with others in an intimate way.
Some of the doctor's initial concern seemed to give way to relief.
That can be a very intense experience. Do you have questions?
No,
Icheb assured him.
I am well aware of the particulars of sexual intimacy.
The doctor nodded.
Of course.
It's just that when intimate contact was initiated, I did not feel what I believe it is normal to feel under those circumstances.
The doctor looked away briefly, clearly processing this information. When he turned back to face Icheb, he said,
I do not wish to pry, Ensign, but can you be more specific as to the nature of the contact and your expectations?
It was just a kiss,
Icheb said.
It surprised me, but it was not unwelcome. In fact, it was a relief. Many concerns and questions I'd had up to that moment were answered.
The doctor smiled.
That sounds about right.
But it wasn't. I wanted to respond. I knew in my mind that this was a good thing, but I didn't feel anything.
What did you expect to feel?
Connection. Excitement.
Icheb ventured. The doctor nodded for him to continue.
My body seemed to grow cold. To shut down,
Icheb said haltingly.
It was the opposite of what I knew I should be feeling.
Perhaps, as much as you might have wanted the contact, you have certain reservations of which your body was making you aware.
Icheb shook his head.
I am intensely attracted in every way imaginable to Finn.
Lieutenant Bryce?
Yes. We have spent a great deal of time together since I joined the fleet. I consider him a good friend, and he made it clear to me tonight that he would like our relationship to proceed beyond that. I want that too. But I don't understand my physical response. Why didn't I feel anything?
The doctor rose and moved closer to Icheb.
There could be many reasons.
He hesitated for a moment, then said,
I hope you will not take this question the wrong way, but is this the first time you have engaged in intimate contact with another man?
Yes. Does that matter?
Not unless there is any hesitation on your part to engage in a same-sex relationship.
Icheb shook his head.
It's not something I've thought about in those terms. I've always believed that attraction was attraction. I would have been open to finding a partner of either gender. Since I've known Finn, however, it's become clear to me that he is my preference.
Okay. Then I assume you have come to me to rule out any physical disorders that might account for what you experienced?
Icheb nodded.
Yes.
The doctor smiled reassuringly.
That should be very simple. We'll perform a quick physical and a few tests, and if, as I assume they will, they show no causes for concern, I will suggest that you discuss this further with Counselor Cambridge.
Icheb shook his head.
I don't believe I am suffering from a psychological disorder.
I don't think you are either, Icheb. But new experiences can be difficult to process. If the issue is not physical, the counselor is the best person qualified to address any underlying psychological challenges.
Icheb nodded.
I have never discussed anything with him, but I know Seven regards him highly.
I would prefer you not share this with him, but so do I,
the doctor admitted.
He can be maddening, and I find his overall approach a little brusque. But he is an excellent counselor. I would not suggest you speak to him otherwise.
Okay.
But first things first. Do you have any objections to allowing Dr. Sherrick to perform the necessary tests?
No, Icheb said. Seven also holds him in the highest esteem.
With good reason. Shall we begin?
Icheb felt something that had been coiled tightly around his chest release just a bit.
Yes, please.
DK-1116. Shortly after Tom Paris's head had hit the pillow attached to his sleeping bag, he had begun to snore softly. Bellana had found sleep more elusive. At first, she had chalked it up to a combination of Miral's unexpected revelation and the ambient noise from the party still in progress by the lake. But within a few hours, the noise outside had died down. Finally, sick of tossing and turning, Torres decided a little air might clear her head. Stepping outside the tent, she realized that the vast majority of officers who had been there earlier had gone back to their respective vessels for the night. She expected this pattern to repeat itself every night of the fleet's stay in orbit. She considered walking toward the trees, but decided to wait to share those explorations with Miral in the morning. Instead, she directed her steps toward the shoreline. As the water's edge came into view, she immediately understood the odd quiet of those still present that were now assembled in small groups along the beach, staring at the lake. Over the water, gorgeous lights, green, purples and blues, cascaded in a spectacle of vibrant beauty that was truly stunning. "Oh my," she said softly. Natural phenomena like this one weren't all that rare, but that didn't make them any less worthy of wonder and awe. Not unlike the aurora borealis on Earth, the rich, pulsing colors were the simple result of the interplay between electrically charged particles released by the binaries hitting the gases present in the atmosphere. She did think it was odd, however, that the particles weren't blocked by the biodome's energy field. Of course, for all she knew, the charged particles were part of the atmosphere being held within, and this was just an unusual side effect. Something about this was unsettling, but she wasn't able to put her finger on it right away. Instead, she wrestled with the choice of whether or not to wake Tom and Miral. She knew that when they heard about it in the morning, they would both be sorry to have missed the sight.
"It's weird, isn't it, Commander?"
a soft voice said behind her. Turning, she saw Lieutenant Bryce gazing out at the same thing that had transfixed her.
"What are you still doing here, Lieutenant?"
Bryce shrugged.
"Who knows when any of us will have a chance to walk by a lake again?"
Torres nodded, wondering why the garrulous Bryce seemed so somber. Of course, it had been a long day for both of them.
"Why do you think it's weird?" Torres asked, looking back to the unusual lights in the sky.
"I can understand the presence of charged particles around some of the constructs. They're primarily metal. But all of the water sources in the biodomes are pure,"
Bryce replied. This was news to Torres.
"They are?"
Bryce nodded.
"I don't know that any of the teams have been focusing on the water sources, but in looking at the energy fields and searching for the conductive pathways, we had to rule out the water. Every sample that has been taken has shown the same property. It is absolutely pure, and therefore not conductive."
"No standing water is that pure," Torres said.
"Particles from the surrounding lake bed or ground would provide for at least minimal impurities."
"Not here,"
Bryce said.
"I haven't analyzed the ground at this site, but in our biodome, the area around the water was silica-based. It's like it was designed to keep the water sources pure."
"What would be the purpose of that?"
Torres wondered aloud.
Bryce shrugged. "Who knows? It might not have been intentional."
"But what if it was?"
"Yeah,"
Bryce said, looking back to the sky.
"Either way, it doesn't matter now. There's no way that lake is a pure water source after a couple hundred of us swam in it today.
And beautiful as that sky is, I don't like it."
Torres didn't either. 12. Voyager. The first sensation of which Ensign Atar Gwyn was aware upon waking
was hunger. This was unusual. But everything was unusual. This wasn't her bed. The lights around her were dim, so it was difficult to determine where she was. She tried to turn on her side, and immediately her right arm protested, sending shocks of icy pain shooting up her arm, side, and neck. That sparked a memory. Her right arm, and excruciating pain. An instinct to flee took hold of her at once, and despite the pain, she forced herself to a sitting position. Tightness across her chest, and a sense of something ripping were her reward for the abrupt motion. A man approached her. An alien. His face was dark brown and spotted. His hairless scalp had a ridge in its center, leading down to a wide nose. His eyes were incredibly kind. She focused her attention on them.
So lonely, she thought at once. He is lost here, but seeks understanding. He misses the stars of his home. He does not believe he will ever see them again.
She wanted to comfort him. No, she needed to comfort him. She would not be whole until his suffering had ended. What's more, she knew she could make it end. For him, she could become the thing that filled his emptiness and made him whole at the same time.
But she was so hungry.
Her stomach rumbled greedily. The absence at the center of her being was agony. Food would help temporarily, but not forever. She had become a creature defined by need.
Ensign?
The alien with the kind eyes spoke to her. Her mouth was a desert. She swallowed, trying to force moisture into barrenness.
Where am I?
She asked.
You are in sick bay, Ensign. You were attacked on your last away mission. We have treated most of your injuries and radiation exposure, but you still need to heal. You require rest.
Hungry,
she said.
It is too soon for food. I can get some water for you, but you must lie down.
She obeyed without question.
She knew him. He was familiar to her, but she had never seen him as clearly as she did now.
All of the new information flooding her senses replaced her previous knowledge, pushing it beyond her grasp. When he returned, he gently lifted her head and helped her sip from a glass of water.
Better?
He asked so kindly. She reached for his hand.
Who are you?
He smiled, confused. He was studying her as much as caring for her. He had a new concern. He was worried about her.
I am Dr. Sherrick. Do you know who you are?
I am Atar Gwyn, she replied.
That's right. Do you know where you are?
She looked around before pulling the answer from his mind. As soon as she found it there, she realized she had known, but been unable to find the answer in the wilds of her new mind.
Sick bay. Voyager.
His relief became hers.
That's right. Very good.
He started to turn away. She reached for his hand.
Don't go,
she said.
I am for you, Dr. Sherrick.
He patted her hand as he would that of a child. This was not what she wanted, but what she wanted did not matter. All that mattered was what he wanted.
I am here for you as well, Ensign. Just rest. You are going to feel better soon.
Until the hunger was filled, there would be no better. She knew that. She also knew he did not understand. He would. In time, she would help him understand. A soft hiss at her neck, and some of the pain in her arm and chest diminished. A wave of weariness washed over her. She did not wish to leave him, but she had no choice. All she could see in her mind's eye was his face drifting farther and farther away from her. She reached for him. Did he sense it? He turned back, touching her forehead with his warm hand. He did. He would be hers. She would be his. The hunger would end.
DK 1116.
Captain Farkas had long since returned to Vesta. O'Donnell and Glenn had each pitched tents around their makeshift campsite and bid the Admiral goodnight. Chakotay had busied himself setting up the tent in which he and Catherine would sleep beside O'Donnell's. Admiral Janeway could hear Commander O'Donnell speaking softly to his XO, reporting some of the day's finds, and discussing personnel issues that had come up on Demeter in his absence. Despite her weariness, Janeway felt certain that sleep was not going to come easy to her tonight. When she had first imagined this time, she had been warmed by the thought of sharing several uninterrupted days and nights with Chakotay. Now she wondered if she might not prefer a little solitude. Chakotay placed a gentle hand on her shoulder.
Ready for bed?
She turned her head to look up at him. His face was as it had ever been, a perfect balance of careworn determination and mischievous idealism.
I don't think so.
I was hoping you'd say that,
he said with a soft smile.
Would you care to take a walk?
Janeway nodded as he helped her rise from her chair. He carried a soft bag over his shoulder as they made their way down the hill and back toward the zombie trees.
It seems you have a destination in mind, Janeway observed.
I do.
They continued on for a bit in companionable silence. Roughly 100 meters into the forest, they came upon a pool of water, too small for a lake, but much larger than a pond. Chakotay knelt beside the water, testing it with his hand. A wide smile crossed his lips.
I remember well your fondness for baths. Will this do?
Despite the misgivings that had complicated her feelings since she arrived, she had to admit that the thought of a midnight swim in calm, warm water sounded like heaven. Chakotay had thought ahead. He removed large towels from his bag and laid them out in preparation for their return to the shore. In pleasant silence, they helped each other out of their uniforms and entered the pool together. For a time, they simply swam about. The pool was probably 12 meters deep at its center, but near the shore they could easily stand submerged up to their necks. Eventually, he reached his hands out to her, and she allowed him to envelop her in an embrace. He kissed her tenderly, and, for a time, all thoughts beyond the comfort and pleasure they gave each other were forgotten. Finally, they emerged from the pool, wrapping themselves in the towels and relaxing in the breeze. When they had settled themselves on the ground, their feet intertwined, Chakotay said,
I hoped coming here would grant you a little peace. Was I wrong?
No, she said. It's wonderful.
Then why aren't you happy?
I am.
His head cocked to the side. He knew her better than that. Janeway considered her next words carefully. After a moment, she said,
Do you think we're wasting our time?
Chakotay's brow furrowed, puzzled.
You mean taking so many days for shore leave?
She shook her head.
Not here. I mean us. Are we just wasting our time together?
I'm not,
he replied.
But I can't speak for you.
She reached her hands out and took his.
We have 2 more years out here. 2 more years of exploring and discovering.
And occasionally fighting for our lives,
he finished for her.
If history is any guide,
she agreed.
You said once that this was all you needed. This is home. Do you still feel that way?
I do.
But in all the time we've had since we found each other again, we haven't really talked about the future beyond those 2 years.
Do we need to?
Janeway shuddered.
I think maybe I do.
Okay. Where do you want to go when this mission is done? Are you ready to retire? The work we do will never be complete, but are you starting to feel that it's time to allow others to carry these burdens?
She released his hands and placed hers under her chin, elbows on her knees for support.
I've never imagined this coming to an end. I've never wanted to.
Chakotay nodded.
So when we're done here, we take whatever command offers next.
What if they want to separate us?
That's not going to work for me.
Janeway smiled. It was a simple statement of fact.
I turned my back on Starfleet a long time ago,
he continued.
You brought me back, and since then I've gone where they asked, when they asked, and done my best to keep those I've led alive. But the days of either of us going where we're told if it can't accommodate our relationship are past, at least for me.
Starfleet might be more willing to acknowledge that if we did. Officially, I mean, Janeway said.
Chakotay's eyes grew wide.
Why, Admiral Janeway, is that a proposal?
Twice in her life, Janeway had been engaged. Neither one had ended in marriage. Both times she had believed they were forever. Both times fate had intervened and taken that away from her. Was it possible that her fear now had nothing to do with Chakotay? Was she simply afraid to believe again?
It's an observation, she finally replied.
To her surprise, he didn't seem wounded.
If marriage is what you want, Catherine, then we will marry. As far as I'm concerned, the only thing we haven't done is legalize our union. But the absence of that doesn't change anything for me. To be honest, I haven't been sure that you even wanted to marry.
You haven't?
She said in genuine surprise.
If I had any doubts, one look at your face when you thought I was offering you a ring took care of that.
She felt her cheeks warming.
Of course he had noticed. I was just taken off guard by the timing, she offered.
No, you weren't.
All right, I wasn't. I was momentarily terrified.
But not because I don't want to be with you.
You're content with where we are now, he said. So am I. Maybe we don't have to know anything else right now.
I am content, but I'm also afraid. I'm not sure I trust this. At times like this, everything seems so clear. But then something always seems to come between us.
That's not going to change because we get married, he said. You and I have been together too long and seen too much to ever lie to each other about that. Set aside the reality that every long-term relationship that has ever been is subject to disagreements, tragedies, and unforeseeable events that can do great damage to its foundation. Forget the fact that all relationships live and die not by any single choice, but by the countless daily choices they contain, the myriad moments where kindness, patience, and understanding prevail over our most base drives of selfishness and self-preservation. The deepest personal betrayals bear within them the seeds of grace and forgiveness. I don't care if we ever marry. For me, nothing can change the fact that your happiness is indistinguishable from mine.
Staring into his dark eyes, she felt the doubts she had nurtured slipping away on a single breath. She reached out to him again, pulling him toward her. Their bodies met, two galaxies subject to the inexorable outward pull of the universe, both determined to remain connected, if only by a bridge of stars. Lieutenant Devi Patel took a deep breath. She stepped back slowly from the door, wishing she knew how to close it. Every other door they had managed to open remained that way. Perhaps leaving the sphere chamber the way they had come would seal all of them. But she couldn't attempt this without the rest of her team. Much as she wanted to explore more of the spheres, she also couldn't do that as long as this eerie chamber was open, and whatever waited in the darkness might be on its way out right now, ready to rip her arms from their sockets and beat her to death with them.
Get a hold of yourself. You're a Starfleet officer. You've spent your entire adult life preparing for this moment. Whatever is back there has been there for thousands of years. Just because it sounds scary doesn't mean it's dangerous.
Reasoning things out helped a little. Tempted as she was to flee down the same hallway Lazarin and the others had taken, she knew that she would lose whatever remaining shreds of credibility she had with them if she showed her fear. Also, the thing in the dark might follow, and she would have led it to three other potential victims.
Just take it slow, she decided.
Every instinct she possessed practically screamed otherwise, but she refused to allow fear to start running this show. She prepared carefully. First, she lit the beacon around her wrist. In the same hand, she held her tricorder. It hadn't done a great job thus far interpreting the data of this strange architecture, but she had to try to collect whatever she could. In her other hand, she held her phaser, set to kill. Nothing could possibly be alive back there, but the feel of her hand around the grip was reassuring. Ready as she would ever be, she stepped into the new space. Her beacon illuminated the walls, which appeared to be simple brown stone. Here alone, the metallic ore that had led them to the cavern was absent. The shriek of metal against metal met her ears again. It wasn't as piercing as the alarm that had sounded when they first tried the door, but it remained unsettling. Friction suggested movement. Lazarin's empathic abilities had sensed disorganized life and rage. She tried not to imagine what those two things might look like conjoined. Roughly 20 meters in, she discovered the source of the strange blue light. All along the walls, more blue spheres were embedded within alcoves above circular openings. They were dimmer than their counterparts in the main room. Many glowed with a barely perceptible grayish hue. She was struck by the random notion that compared to the data spheres, these seemed to be dying. The first opening wasn't covered by a door. Instead, a faint trembling of the light indicated a force field. Focusing her beacon into the space beyond, she saw a small form resting on the floor of the otherwise empty cell. It was vaguely spherical, less than a meter in diameter, and mostly metal, a strange hybrid of the silver and black they had found everywhere. Draped all around the object were long, rusty brown tentacles. They seemed to extend from within the metal, but they appeared to be organic. Whatever this thing is, it's not alive. She comforted herself with this thought, until the moment the light from her beacon found a tentacle that extended out from the metal all the way to the far wall of the cell. It appeared to be taut. As she played her light over it, the tentacle snapped toward her, hitting the force field with a slap of electric energy. She stumbled back, her heart racing. "It can't hurt you from in there," she said aloud. She didn't honestly believe that, but she sure as hell hoped it was true. Lifting her hand, she used the beacon to illuminate as much of the rest of the corridor of cells as she could. Shadows remained in the far distance, but between her and them were several more cells, and the metal screeching didn't sound that far off as it occasionally bounced off the walls toward her. Emboldened, she continued forward. Each cell contained a variation on the same theme as the first. Chunks of metal in varying shapes, all with visible organic components. By far the most disturbing was one that appeared at first to be a large, relatively flat metal plane, smooth except for every few meters where soft tissue resembling lips protruded. They opened and closed as if trying to breathe or gasp or suck or wail. A few of the mouth-like openings even contained small metallic teeth. As she passed and noted the contents of each cell, her terror was transmuted into horrified fascination. What was this place? If the spheres and workstations were a library of data, this felt more like a zoo. One potential answer to her question lay near the end of the cavern, in a cell whose sphere glowed more intensely than the others. Patel steeled herself as she stepped toward the force field. Here, the screeching sound reached a pitch almost as deafening as the screams that had sounded the first time Lazarin had approached the door to this chamber of horrors. There was no doubt in her mind that this was the source of the sound. The cell was darker than the others. The object within had no reflective surfaces. It was not solid metal. At first, it looked like a blob of black, viscous liquid a little more than 2 meters long end to end, lying in the center of the cell. Where the other figures had small features that moved, this one was in constant motion. It writhed in apparent agony as distinct shapes undulated into being briefly, only to lose cohesion and dissolve back into an unformed mass. Patel watched the spectacle, a sick pit growing in her stomach, as some of the emerging shapes became more coherent. An arm? A leg? A torso? Her mind rejected what she was seeing. It was impossible.
You are simply trying to make sense of this,
a calm, rational voice insisted. But that explanation lost credibility when one end of the black mass seemed to push itself up into being, a head above a torso and two arms emerging clearly. As soon as the head turned to face her, shrieks of unutterable pain reverberating all around her, Patel glimpsed the features of the face. It was like looking into a mirror. The shape of the face was hers. Morbid fascination held her there for a few seconds as the shape of the face distorted and then settled again into something recognizable as herself. The things in the other cells, those were finished works. This thing was in the process of becoming, and whatever else it was, part of it was her. Patel retreated a few steps, trying desperately to calm herself. As she did so, the form seemed to briefly solidify. She stared at a grotesque mirror image, where her flesh was black fluid and her uniform was twisted metal. Its lips moved, not simply opening in a cry, but with greater precision, although the noise was still a shriek. From above, however, the sphere, Patel quickly realized, a more familiar sound reverberated.
Interlocutor complete. Is this interface acceptable?
No, Patel wanted to scream. If watching the thing taking shape had been alarming, hearing it speak to her was a vision that was going to populate her nightmares for years to come. The creature repeated the question.
Is this interface acceptable?
I understand you if that's what you're asking, Patel replied.
Interface established.
There were a million questions running through Patel's mind, but she found it difficult to settle on just one. The obvious was the first she uttered.
What are you? She asked.
Interface for species 196.2, the thing replied.
Suddenly Patel was struck by a thought. Looking at her punctured palm, she asked,
Did you create yourself using my blood?
Biological sampling is mandatory for all species.
That sounded like a yes.
What is the purpose of the creation of this interface?
Interface is required for proper data retrieval and classification. Species 196.2 has been detected in 12 experimental stations. Environmental modifications for all inhabited stations complete.
You altered the atmosphere within the biodomes to accommodate us?
Environmental modifications for all inhabited stations complete.
Whatever this thing was, there were obviously limits to its linguistic parameters.
What is this place? Patel asked.
Sector 4, data storage and retrieval.
No, not this room. This planet, Patel said, growing impatient.
Imprecise query.
Okay. Patel said, not really understanding why this was a hard question. She tried another tack.
Are you responsible for the creation and maintenance of the environmental systems operating in Sector 4?
Interlocutor interface required for data storage and retrieval.
That sounded like a no.
Who created this system?
Species 001.
Does Species 001 have a name? A high-pitched tone, followed by several clicks and a wheeze, was the answer to this question. Clearly, whatever the name of Species 001 was, there wasn't a word for it in Patel's language.
Are any representatives of Species 001 present now?
Negative.
For what purpose did Species 001 create the system?
Evaluation and propagation of the Edremaya.
Edremaya? That wasn't a word this thing could have pulled from whatever limited exposure it had to Patel's knowledge.
What is the Edremaya?
Object of inquiry.
This was as frustrating as it was illuminating.
What is the current status of the operating system?
Containment system modifications detected. These modifications will result in system termination and closure.
That didn't sound good. In fact, that sounded like something Patel's commanding officers needed to know immediately.
How long until system closure is complete?
At current penetration rates, system will be terminated in 11 hours, 16 minutes, 9 seconds.
Can you reverse the modifications?
Negative.
What happens when the system termination enclosure is complete?
Insufficient data.
It's your system. You don't know?
Containment created to delay system termination in order to determine intent of Idramaya. Insufficient data present to determine intent.
Pieces of this puzzle were starting to fall into place in Patel's mind. You are saying that species 001 came here and created this system in order to evaluate the intention of the Idramaya and to propagate it if possible?
Affirmative.
But they never gathered enough data to determine intent or to recreate the Idramaya?
Affirmative.
And the actions of species 196.2 have broken system containment?
Affirmative.
Will this containment failure and system closure affect the data stored here?
Do you wish to secure Sector 4 data storage?
Absolutely. Yes, Patel replied automatically.
Security protocol enabled.
Good. Thank you, Patel said. There were so many more questions to be asked. But before she could do so, the form began to undulate again as if it was losing cohesion.
Wait! Where are you going?
All available power required for security maintenance. Interface system will be terminated.
No!
Patel cried out.
Wait, please!
The light above the alcove flickered and dimmed. Her doppelganger melted to the floor, where it remained, a torso of metal, melted arms, and a face of black goo tipped forward as if it had suddenly decided to take a nap. Considering the occupants of the other cells, it occurred to Patel that this interface would continue to exist, probably in this form, for as long as the sector for data retrieval and storage system remained intact. It was as comforting as it was horrifying. Lazarin had sensed life and anger from the inhabitants of these cells. Given how long some of them had been here, she understood the anger. The life was harder to quantify, but equally unmistakable. Patel bolted back down the corridor, running headlong into a solid form that grabbed her firmly.
Devi?
The arms that held her were Lazarin's. Behind him, Vincent and Japel stared at her in wide-eyed alarm.
Go!
Was all she could manage.
Devi, calm down,
Lazarin pleaded. He was just this side of trying to shake some sense into her. It was much too late for that. Patel pushed him forward, hurrying the team back down the corridor. When they reached the sphere room again, Devi took a second to orient herself. Three of the four doors that accessed the sphere room were still open. One of them was the entrance to the Cavern of Horrors she had just escaped. The other two led to the staircase Lazarin had just descended and the column room. The door directly across from her, however, the door that led out of the chamber and back to the cavern from which they could request emergency transport and inform the fleet of all she had just learned, had closed while she was otherwise engaged by the interface that seemed to share her DNA. Patel and her team were trapped. Voyager. Acting Captain Harry Kim stared at the bridge's main view screen, trying desperately to process the information his eyes and the ship's scanners were providing. The screen was set at its highest magnification. Centered on it was the Van Cees, the shuttle Gwyn and Seven had taken on their ill-fated journey to collect rock samples from the B-Star's asteroid belt. Only it wasn't really a shuttle anymore. Somehow in the 5 hours since Seven and Gwyn had requested emergency transport and left the shuttle at station keeping, the black, viscous substance that had attacked Gwyn had recovered from the blast of Seven's phaser and begun to consume the shuttle. The bow, the point farthest from the airlock in which Gwyn's suit and the unknown matter had been sealed, was the only part of the shuttle that was still visibly intact. How long that would remain true was anyone's guess, but likely not long. The rest of the ship no longer held its former shape. Instead, an area roughly the size of the shuttle writhed and gyrated as the alien substance seemed to remake every section of the ship it touched. Long, whip-like tentacles shot forth randomly, striking out wildly. Despite its pitch-black coloring, the light of the binaries illuminated the spectacle, giving the matter a silver-blue tint.
"Can anybody tell me what that is or what it's doing apart from the obvious?"
Kim asked. Waters was the first to offer a response from Ops.
"It's eating the ship, sir."
Kim turned on her.
"It's alive?"
Waters studied her display for a few more seconds.
"At this distance, our sensor readings are inconclusive, but they suggest organic and inorganic properties."
"Making it what?"
Kim asked.
"Living technology,"
Waters ventured.
"How do you figure that?"
"The matter that was once the shuttle is being consumed, but as that happens, it is being transformed. It is being utilized as this thing remakes it into something else. Whatever the alien matter once was, it is no longer a discrete entity. What we are seeing is a new thing, a combination of the alien substance and our technology."
Kim shook his head.
"What the hell could do that?"
Waters shrugged.
"To answer that, we need to get closer."
The part of Kim that lived for a new scientific mystery agreed. The part of him that had command of Voyager protested vehemently.
"How close can we safely get?" Kim asked.
"The range of those tentacles is almost half a kilometer and growing longer every second. By the time we could break orbit and position ourselves to take better scans, they might be able to reach Voyager's hull. That is, assuming they continue to grow at a constant rate."
"It's also closing in on our position, Captain,"
Aubrey advised from tactical.
"It is moving toward us at a speed close to 1/4 impulse."
"Why would it do that?" Gleese asked from the helm.
"It's had a taste of our tech, and perhaps it senses that another meal is within range," Kim replied. "Can we break orbit and just get a little closer?"
he asked.
"Aye, sir," Waters said. "But you should be advised that Patel's away team is now half an hour overdue for their check-in, and I've lost my lock on their life signs."
"When did that happen?"
3 minutes ago, sir."
So breaking orbit was out of the question. Kim hated to give the order he was about to give, but under the circumstances, it was the right one. There was no way to perfectly categorize the spectacle they were witnessing, and the sensor data they had received thus far might yield more information on closer study than was possible at this moment. Should his superior officers take issue with the order, it was likely that there was more of the original substance on the asteroid where Seven and Gwyn had landed. A safer means of sampling and studying it might yet be devised. But for now, his choices were limited to one.
"Ensign Gleese, adjust our orbit to provide the widest possible angle of visibility for our targeting sensors. Lieutenant Aubrey, assuming the entity out there doesn't alter course or speed, the moment it is within weapons range, target it and vaporize it. I want it reduced to its subatomic essence. I don't want a stray atom of that matter to remain. Are we clear?"
"Perfectly, sir,"
Aubrey replied.
"In the meantime, Waters, I need you to locate our lost away team."
"Already on it, sir,"
Waters replied.
"It's not like they could have gone far."
"You have no idea how far they might have gone,"
Kim snapped.
"What we have already seen of this planet presents us with technological mysteries that we are nowhere near understanding, let alone mastering. Assume nothing. Imagine the most ridiculous possibilities and eliminate each of them before you report any conclusions to me. Understood?"
Waters nodded, appropriately chagrined.
"Aye, Captain."
"Astrometrics to the bridge,"
Seven's voice rang out clearly over the comm.
"What is it, Seven?"
Kim asked.
"Please report here immediately."
Kim fought briefly for the strength to be courteous. When he had won that battle, he replied,
"We've got our hands full up here, Seven. Can it wait?"
"If it could, I would have sent you a report, Captain. As I haven't, you should assume that it cannot."
This was the job Kim wanted. Nothing in his training or 11 years of personal observation had ever suggested to Kim that it would be easy. Still, it was hard to believe that what was supposed to be a simple and restorative exploratory mission was so quickly devolving into chaos.
"Stand by, Seven,"
Kim ordered.
"Aubrey, estimate to weapons lock?"
20 minutes, sir."
Kim could be back by then. He hoped.
"Aubrey, maintain your station, but for the next few minutes, the bridge is yours."
"Aye, Captain,"
the tactical officer acknowledged. Kim entered the astrometrics lab expecting to see the program running its 10,000th simulation. Instead, the program appeared to be frozen. Seven stood at the data console, simply observing the image before her. Stepping toward the interface station, he studied the image on the massive screen and found it eerily similar to the existing images of the system he'd been looking at off and on all day.
I could have sworn I ordered you to get some sleep, Kim noted.
I simply stopped by to check the simulation's progress on the way to my quarters, Seven said. To my surprise, it has yielded an unexpected result.
Seven ordered the computer to rerun its last simulation and yawned as the program loaded. Seconds later, Kim was staring at a system with a single star orbited by six planets. As he watched, a large terrestrial body came within range of the system. It was too big to be a comet or asteroid. Its dimensions placed it closer to the category of rogue planetoid. Moments later, another body entered the system, apparently guided by the planetoid. A small star. His jaw slack, Kim watched as the two bodies moved through the system, their presence causing catastrophic destruction of every planet present. Eventually, both bodies were caught in the gravity of the star, and the planetoid was destroyed, while the star settled into a stable orbit. A binary system was born, out of nearly impossible circumstances.
That rogue planet was dragging a star behind it, Kim said softly.
Yes, Seven agreed.
Meaning it couldn't possibly have been a planet. It had to be a ship of some sort.
Having just completed a survey of dozens of fragments of that planet, and discovering several more unusual mineral formations, including a toxic substance that nearly ate Ensign Gwyn, I must contradict that assessment, Seven said evenly.
That's impossible. It had to have propulsion, not to mention one hell of a tractor mechanism to keep hold of a star that size. I can't even imagine the gravitational geometry required to attempt such a thing, let alone believe that it occurred naturally.
I am all but certain it did not, Seven said. But that is not the most interesting part of this simulation.
What is?
Note the final result, Seven suggested.
Kim tore his eyes from the binaries and studied the debris field. It was massive and in constant motion. It would take thousands of years to settle into the configuration of the current system. Then it hit him.
Where is DK-1116? Kim asked.
It's not there, Seven said. None of the previous planetary bodies could have survived the transit of the planetoid or the star as they moved through the system.
Then where did the planet our people are currently studying come from? Kim demanded.
An excellent question, Seven said.
As Kim pondered the possible answers, Seven switched the view on the screen to the last image taken by the long-range sensors of the system and its surrounding asteroid belt. A faint bleep sounded on her panel, alerting her to a new reading.
Hmm,
Seven said.
Hmm?
Kim asked.
Approximately 6 hours ago, a faint but perceptible EM energy wave was detected from an asteroid in the outer belt. It is focused on the planet and has increased in intensity by fractional amounts every hour since it was first identified.
Source?
Seven shrugged. We need to take a closer look to confirm, but at this range, there is no sign of technology anywhere in the asteroid field.
Kim nodded.
I think it's time to make contact with our commanding officers.
13. DK-1116. Unable to accept the reality now before her, Devi Patel stepped toward the sphere room's only known exit to the surface. Placing her hand in its center, she waited for the familiar pinpricks to her palm required to activate the cavern's entrance doors. Nothing happened. Resisting the urge to panic, she ran both of her hands over its surface. Again, nothing.
Devi, what is going on?
Lazarin demanded.
Why is that door closed?
Japel asked, noticeably panicked.
I don't know, Patel snapped back at him.
As she stood before the metal surface now standing between her and a long, productive life, she forced herself to take slow, regular breaths and consider the question. Suddenly, she did know. She knew exactly why that door was closed. It was her fault. Tapping her comm badge, she said, "Patel to Voyager. Voyager, do you read me?" Silence answered. Not even static. "Voyager, please respond." She tried again several times before accepting the obvious. Her comm signal had been blocked when she tried to reach Lazarin and the others when they were separated. Something down here inhibited them. Turning back to her team, she lifted her chin slightly and said, "We have a number of problems."
"Is one of them that closed door?"
Japel asked. "Yes, but it may not be the biggest one." Lazarin stepped forward.
"Explain,"
he requested in a tone that reminded Patel annoyingly of Seven.
"Remember the screaming sound?"
she asked. Lazarin and the others nodded.
"That sound was the formation of an interface that was created using my DNA in order to interact with us. It is located in a cell in that room," she added, pointing to the entrance directly behind Vincent. "And it is no longer operative."
As she continued, Vincent looked toward that chamber nervously and stepped closer to the others.
"The interface told me that containment on the surface has been breached by the actions of our crews."
"How?"
Japel demanded.
"It didn't say."
"You didn't ask?"
"You know what?" Patel said. "The next time the four of us are working together, I'm going to let you take charge, Japel. That way you can witness the birth of a monster bearing your face and try to have a conversation with it. And when you do better than I did at getting all of our questions answered, you can start criticizing me."
Japel's face fell.
"I'm sorry,"
he said immediately.
"I didn't mean..."
"I know," Patel said more gently. "It's a lot to take in all at once."
"Do you have any idea what it meant when it said that we had breached containment?"
Lazarin asked.
"No," Patel replied. "But there is a definite possibility it might include the failure of the biodomes in which our people are currently exploring and enjoying shore leave. It said the system would fail in a little over 11 hours, so it's not something that is an immediate threat. I have to hope that there are signs on the surface of the impending system failure, and that all of our people will get off the surface in time. But if there aren't, we need to find a way to warn them."
"Those biodomes have stood for thousands of years. We've been here a little more than a day, and we already found a way to break them,"
Vincent asked, aghast.
"Not that long ago, we almost broke the entire multiverse,"
Lazarin reminded him.
"We're good."
"That still doesn't seem possible," Vincent said,
clearly turning the prospect over and over in his mind.
"The species that built all of this was identified as Species 001. Every other species that has come here is also numbered. We are 196.2.
"0.2?
Japel asked.
"Really?"
Patel shot back.
"You're standing in the middle of this, and the decimal point is what's throwing you?"
Japel shook his head.
"I'm guessing that the other species explored this place under the supervision of Species 001, so they probably had access to rules and regulations we don't. This whole world is one gigantic science lab built to evaluate and, if possible, propagate something called the Edremaya."
She held up her hand to forestall more questions as she continued.
"I don't know what that is exactly, but I'm guessing it is whatever substance, including the Seven of Ninonium, all of those structures on the surface are made out of."
"You might be right about that,"
Lazarin said.
"You need to see the cavern down below."
"What's down there?"
she asked.
"The motherload of impossible things,"
he replied.
"It's going to take several teams of our best people working for weeks to crack that code."
"Noted," Patel said. "Now here's the part you're not going to like."
"You mean the other part we're not going to like?"
Vincent asked.
"Because seriously, Devi, there isn't a single part of this yet that I'm actually liking."
Patel sighed.
"When the interface told me that system failure was imminent, it asked if I wanted to secure this data storage and retrieval station. I didn't think. I just said yes.
A look of understanding came over Lazarin's face.
Oh no,
he said. Patel nodded.
I think so.